Welcome to the podcast series for AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I'm your host, Kara Hansel-Kean. Today we'll discuss the article by Chryselius et al. Titled, Signaling of Immediate Exercise Hyperemia. This article published online May 3rd, 2013. My guests today are Associate Editor AJ Shaw, Lead Author Frank Deneno, and Expert Michael Joyner. Let's get started.
Hello, everyone. I'm delighted that we're discussing an interesting clinical paper today, clinical investigation of actually what seems to be a fundamental physiological mechanism in humans. So if I can start with you, Frank, maybe you could give us a short summary of what you think this paper adds to the literature.
Thanks, AJ. We undertook this study to try to gain a better understanding of what the signaling mechanisms are in response to a brief muscle contraction in humans. We know that upon the release of one single contraction, there is an immediate vasodilatory response. However, the mechanisms to date are currently unknown. And in this study, we tested the hypothesis that potassium-mediated vascular hyperpolarization played a prominent role in the immediate dilatory response. And we also tested the hypothesis that nitric oxide and prostaglandins do not play a role. And what we found through a variety of experimental protocols was that when we inhibit potassium-mediated dilation, we can reduce the peak dilatory response to a single muscle contraction by about 40 to 50%, and the total dilatory response, or the area under the curve, by about 60 to 65%. When we inhibit nitric oxide and prostaglandins, and this was in contrast to what we thought was going to occur, we further attenuated the peak response as well as the total area under the curve. When we block all four pathways, or if we block potassium-mediated responses as well as combined nitric oxide and prostaglandin responses, we can abolish the response or nearly abolish the response by about 80%. And so we think we've identified the primary pathways involved in this immediate vasodilatory response, which could serve as a feed-forward mechanism to increase blood flow and oxygen delivery to active tissue.
Thanks, Frank. Mike, your thoughts on the paper?
The whole issue of what drives exercise hyperemia is really baffled people no matter what model they were working in since at least the 1850s or 1860s, 1870s. And I think that this is a major step forward in trying to unravel some of these responses. And one of the advantages of doing humans as opposed to, say, electrical stimulation in an animal model or an isolated tissue is that you can actually see what happens during voluntary exercise. And by using this kind of brachial artery forearm blood flow model, you're able to essentially do organ bath studies in conscious humans, or studies that have a lot of parallels with organ bath studies. So I think it is a real step forward. And then I think the real question is going to be, are the mechanisms which initiate the dilation the same or different than those that which sustain it over time?
That was actually going to be one of my questions, which is, what do you think, both of you, what do you think is the relevance of these important mechanisms that you've identified in the context of steady state exercise?
We're now able to extend the pharmacology that we've developed in the lab over the last few years to address those questions. And we have completed a series of studies trying to identify how much these pathways in total contribute to steady state exercise hyperemia, but also the onset of exercise hyperemia from the initial contraction through, 30 seconds, 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, all the way out to steady state levels. And what we see is that it contributes to the immediate response. It contributes over the first 30 seconds to a minute. And if we keep the drugs infused, and this is the tricky part from an experimental standpoint, if we keep the drugs going in, depending on what exercise intensity we have our subjects perform, we can reduce steady state hyperemia by about 25 to 35%.
And AJ, one of the things we've done over the years is actually give drugs on top of ongoing vasodilation. And when we do that, when we give nitric oxide synthase inhibitors or cyclooxygenase inhibitors, you see a drop in flow of perhaps 15 or 20%, as Frank mentioned. We, in the past, have given some KATP channels on top of LNMMA, nitric oxide synthase inhibition, and COX inhibition. And at steady state, it didn't do much, but we've had some interesting kind of individual responses where you'll have really almost a big reduction in the blood flow for a few contractions and then a rebound. So one of the problems here is that if you reduce the blood flow more than, say, 20 or 30 or 40%, you may do enough to oxygen delivery that you start producing other metabolic vasodilating signals. So what Frank just said would not surprise me. Once you start getting to 30 or 40%, it would really become unclear whether the mechanisms might contribute more or whether you've just reduced blood flow enough to evoke other metabolic dilating signals to kind of compensate for things.
No, that makes sense. The other question is to do with the mechanisms that are involved in this interesting effect. So I think that's really hard to study in patients, but how do you think the nitric oxide and the prostaglandins are released? What are the signals for that?
I mean, let's just go down the laundry list. So you could have nitric oxide just coming off the vascular endothelium, but that would suggest it was really maybe more of a product of flow-mediated dilation and was amplifying a dilating signal as opposed to being the primary dilating substance. The prostaglandins, probably shear stress, and what's really interesting about this is if you actually give humans exogenous vasodilating prostaglandins, about half of the dilation is caused by stimulation of nitric oxide release. So there's a lot of crosstalk between those pathways. And then as you mentioned ATP, the potential for ATP to come off red blood cells either from mechanical deformation or as a result of desaturation. Those are two, I guess, new ideas.
Now, Frank, looking forward, where do you think this work's going?
So the development of some of the pharmacology utilizing low-dose infusion of barium chloride, we've been doing this in the lab for a few years. We've been testing ideas related to reactive hyperemia, steady state exercise hyperemia, how the sympathetic nervous system interacts with local factors during exercise to modulate vascular tone. And so these are all very basic physiology studies that we're trying to just gain a better understanding of the signaling mechanisms involved. And then we have some ideas related to aging and disease models, because many of these pathways and many of these basic responses, either my lab or Mike's lab or other labs have shown. For example, with aging, you have impaired rapid vasodilatory mechanisms.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I really liked about your paper was exactly that, that you're really probing fundamental mechanisms very, very carefully in a difficult, I would say, human context. One of the things that I like to do, actually reading a paper or as an editor, is kind of glance through some of the references. And so I looked at your reference number one, which of course was ANREP, who I think is probably better known for the cardiac ANREP effect. So I checked him out, and you could do the same, you know, quick Wikipedia and internet search. But he turns out to be a really fascinating person for lots and lots of reasons. You would probably never guess that this work that you are studying now, Frank, ANREP did this when he was professor of physiology in the University of Cairo in Egypt. And I never knew that there was a famous Egyptian physiologist. So it turns out he's a Russian-born physiologist who, after the Tsar was overthrown, moved to England, worked in London and Cambridge, which is where he did the cardiac work with the ANREP effect.
Yeah.
But then for a reason that's not clear to me and was not outlined in this article, he then moved to Egypt. And it's fascinating because the entire paper is composed of representative examples of very carefully performed experiments. You know, we would just never get anything like that published today.
That was one of the great things of working with Mike, actually, as a postdoc, is he has kind of that older school physiologist mentality. And we used to often joke about how, you know, many of the older physiology studies, even if it was with an N of one in a patient that was surgically sympathectomized, and then it would lead to a three-page discussion on the physiological implications of it. And you're right, we just can't get away with doing that anymore.
Well, you know, AJ, what's quite interesting about this, too, is at the same time Alam and Smirk would have been in Cairo. Alam was an Egyptian, but Smirk was a New Zealander who did these terrific studies at about the same time, published them in the J Physiology and also Clinical Science on the muscle pressor reflex.
In Cairo.
in Cairo. They were there, and Smirk went on. I think Smirk might have been knighted. Smirk went back to New Zealand and was one of the first people to recognize that hypertension was a public health problem and treat it with ganglionic blockers.
Well, that's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much indeed, Frank and Mike, and I hope the audience enjoy our little discussion.
You've been listening to an AJP Heart and Circ podcast. For more podcasts, visit us online at ajpheart.physiology.org. Thank you.